Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. This guy is very different from my other guests, but I think you're going to love him. He is the author of two books, The Day After, The Life and Times of a New York FBI Agent, which is his second book, and the first book is Just Another Day. So Jason Randazzo is an author, a retired former NYPD police officer. No, former NYPD police officer and a retired special agent, FBI agent. So he is the real deal, and he wrote these books, and I recommend them highly, and I'm going to bring him to the stage. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you very much, Hillary. Very nice introduction. I appreciate it. It was nice.
All right, good. So I spent the last weekend reading his book. So I feel like I'm also on the streets, in the cars, chasing fugitives and busting up drug busts, all the things that he used to do. So if you're interested in that life, and it's not, I'm assuming, it's not a movie. This was the real thing. So one of my questions is, I know sometimes you change the names, but yes. I'm assuming a lot of times it was their real names. And how was that okay that you could do that? How were you allowed to do that?
Let me first offer that the stories in the books are all true. Everything that I wrote in there is things that did happen in real life. And I bet just about all the names I think that I put in the book are the real names. There was no real rules, hard and fast, if I did change some names. I know one in particular was a name that I had in terms of, it wasn't a case I worked, but it was actual, a personally involved case that I had in which I was friends. As well as a group of friends that I hung with at the time. And I'm talking about back in the, late 70s, early 80s.
When you were growing up, these were your boyhood friends, right?
Yeah, yes. And actually, this is before I even became a police officer. I grew up, I was born in Brooklyn. I grew up raised in Queens. And there was a point where my friends and I had become friendly. Some of my friends had known a gentleman named John DeAgnes through the Boys Club. And John had opened a bar with a friend of his who was a Vietnam War veteran named Richard Gotkin. They opened a bar in Woodhaven, Queens. And just on the basis that we knew John, it became a place that we thought we'd feel comfortable going and hanging out on weekends as well as a lot of our friends from the neighborhood. But unfortunately there came a time and we were there all the time. I mean, I still remember watching the Super Bowl where the Raiders beat the Eagles at that bar. I think that was 1980. And I mean, we were there every Friday and Saturday night. Can't miss. On one weekend night, we decided, let's do something different. There's this club on Long Island, obviously not there anymore, 40 years ago, called Speaks, that had a band that we wanted to see. So we got into somebody's car. We drove out there. I was out on in Island Park, Long Island, and we were gone for the night. And obviously, these are days before cell phones, so we didn't become aware about it until I guess either somebody got home and got to a phone or the next day. But both John and Rich were shot to death at that bar that night. And what had happened is they were there, and there was a guy that was there that was there with his girlfriend, and went from spill drink to, let us give you a drink, an apology from whoever spilled it, what have you. And this guy felt disrespected, and unfortunately, this guy who in our neighborhood at the time, being that we were very close in relation, geographically speaking, to an area, Ozone Park, and more prominently known, Howard Beach, that had a very well-known Italian organized crime element there, both in not only congregating at a club. It was called the Bergen Hunt and Fish Club on 101st Avenue, but also a lot of the members of that club of the Gambino crime family lived in Howard Beach. Unfortunately, this knucklehead was friendly with members of that crime family, and upon feeling disrespected about this spilled drink, left with his girlfriend after he just didn't want to have the drinks that were offered to him gratis and an apology, and they said, "You got to leave." Well, he left, and he came back with two other guys who were members and associates of this crime family, and they came in and shot John first, and then Rich hopped over the bar to help his friend, and they shot and killed both of them. So there was a whole story to this in which it incorporated a lot of things. There were things at the DA's office that were let's say didn't ring out, and as far as the prosecution of these guys, which didn't happen for quite a while, and years later under an administration that was far down the line. There was also rumors of police interference with the investigation of this. So the short of it is that the three individuals that were involved in this incident didn't face justice. And I detail in my book about what had happened, and it was pretty intriguing. There were a lot of aspects to it that finally brought it to a head. I believe like 20 or so years later, where the Queens District Attorney's Office finally did prosecute the people that were involved, and they did get convictions in this matter so many years later. And I mean, there were,
Were you a policeman then, or had you not
no, this is
been
before I
educated?
became a cop. This is when I was just another guy in the neighborhood, just hanging out with my friends. And
And how old were you then?
I believe it or not, back in the time, I had just kind of stayed ahead of the drinking age. So the drinking age was 18. Not to say that that was my first time in a bar, obviously, as most people back then were
Right.
getting in there whenever they the bouncers would let them. But I guess I was, I guess, 19, 20 years old, I guess, at the
Okay.
time.
So, what kind of impression did that make on you? Like, what did you, was that just normal?
Well,
Because I know when you were talking about, there were always gangs and there were fights, but I don't think it was killing when you were
no.
growing up. People would punch each other and that was it. When did
Yeah, I
it
mean,
become like, I'm dissed, boom, you're dead? Like, that's
yeah.
kind of final.
Yeah, I mean, as far as my friends, my contemporaries, my peers were concerned, I mean, we grew up, we hung out, we had names of our groups. We got into fights with other people, which I also talk about. in the first book. When I say we were gangs, I'm talking about really like loosely associated people that were involved with guns, drugs, even weapons. No, we would have fights with other, you know.
You had groups. Baseball games and football games, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's mostly where we shelved out our aggressions on each other, because we did have football teams that played against each other. But, and there were groups there were groups in the neighborhood that were associated with that. And there were groups that were even more hardcore, who aligned themselves with some of the organized crime people and got involved in dealing drugs. And it's funny, I also mentioned in the book about there was a place in Queens, Forest Park, where there was a place called, we called it the Dome. It's like a semicircular band shell up in the park that had this obviously large parking lot to accommodate the people that would come up here to hear concerts. But on the weekends, it was just a drug bazaar. It was just a free for all there. As a matter of fact, Jimmy Breslin, who was a prolific writer for the New York Daily News back in the day, I remember he wrote an article, well, maybe not an article about the Dome, but he did mention that the Dome was like the drug capital of the East Coast. It was a place that you go there, particularly Friday, Saturday nights, filled with people, with cars, just either people just looking to hang out, looking to listen to music, and looking to cop drugs. And, of course, you know, some of the people I hung out with, I mean, I never myself, unlike some of the friends that I grew up with, got involved in drugs or used drugs. I never delved in anything more than marijuana on a few handful of times back then. And something I never picked up on. It just wasn't me. But unfortunately, I knew people and who would go to the Dome and go to other places. They would, it was funny.
Did you ever hang out there, even though you didn't do drugs, or that just wasn't your?
I've been there. I mean, it was like a wonderland. You go up there and you saw people you know, people you don't know, people from all over Brooklyn, Queens, Long Island. They would come there, and you could, if there was a drug you wanted, easily gotten there, probably by four or five different people. It was just an amazing scene, and it was so open. Like, this wasn't a covert place. I mean, it was a parking lot, so you could just see it just going up the drive into the park.
Wow.
And it was amazing that the police weren't there more often. I mean, finally, there came a time where they cracked down and cleared out the mess that was up there. But for the longest time, the Dome was synonymous with what are we doing tonight? We can get anything we want. It was amazing.
Okay, so part of your growing up, you had your athletic friends. Some of them went one way into drugs. They went into crime. You know, they got into jail, or a lot of them died. Yeah. You went.
And believe it or not, some of those athletic friends were heavy drug users at times.
Wow.
But I guess we were all young, you know, so it didn't really impede upon what they did. It was unbelievable, yeah.
But some, like, maybe they were, but some straightened out and some had real careers and families, right? You mm-hmm. know, you went and had your career, obviously.
Correct.
Law enforcement, which is
yes.
the opposite of, seems, the gangs and the you know,
yeah.
mafia or whatever you call it now. But like, what do you think was the difference that you went into? I mean, law enforcement, they went into breaking laws, you know, like,
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
there you are, you're growing up on the same street, playing the same game. And yet, boom.
Yeah.
Like, what made you go one way and them another, do you think?
I guess I definitely have to owe a lot to my mother. I mean, I lived alone with my mother. I was raised by my mother. I had no siblings. So she and I lived in an apartment.
What about your dad? was your dad?
My dad left my mother when I was at a young age.
Okay.
And he came into my life later on, and he would visit me. I mean, there was a point where I hadn't seen him, but then he was coming around again. I was his only child, so there was a point where he did come around and take me out, and we formed a relationship that just slowly built up into when I became a teenager, started taking me on a couple trips, whether it be skiing, Puerto Rico, what have you. And then when I finished college and went to the New York City Police Academy, it was at the time, it's now in Queens, but at the time it was on East 20th Street off of 3rd Avenue. And my father had a travel agency, insurance, the taxes, personal taxes, and it was located on East 14th Street between 1st Avenue and Avenue A, right by Alphabet City. So I was able, at the time we were doing alternate weeks, 8 to 4, 4 to 12, Monday through Friday. So on the second week, 8 to 4, I would walk over and see my father. And from then on into my 20s, for the next 6 years until he passed away, we developed a stronger relationship, a stronger bond. So he had a lot more influence on me later on. My father, although he didn't go to college, he was a very well-read individual, actually played the piano well enough that if he had kept that, he probably could have been a concert pianist.
Wow.
But yeah, and it was very interesting going to my father's office. He was in this like railroad office on East 14th Street, and my father was first generation American Italian. His parents came over from
Italian.
Italy. Yes,
Italian. Oh wow,
yeah, no, yeah, hence my last name. Right. Sicilian, as a matter of fact. Well,
I thought you kept saying these Irish boys with the red hair. What was your mom?
She was Irish, English, Polish.
Oh, okay. So that's your Irish half. Okay.
Yeah, I guess so. My Irish appearance. I have my father's facial features, but I guess I got my mother's coloring. So that's why people assume that I'm Irish upon appearance.
But, right. Well, I don't know. I thought you kept saying that in the book, but maybe you were talking about the other guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it was funny. I used to go see my father, and I'd go over to D. Robertus over on First Avenue and get him a double espresso, and Pauline, who worked at the front of the office, a cappuccino. I'd have a cappuccino, and I'd sit there, and although my father had the business, he did a lot of things for the Italian community. You know, at the time, there was still a lot of Italian immigrants from, especially in Brooklyn, Bensonhurst, Bay Ridge, who were, you know, doing things as any immigrants did and making a living. But there was also things that would come in where they would get letters from the government or other entities that they didn't know what they didn't understand. And, you know, there could be a time when I'm sitting in my father's office and a couple, Italian couple would come in or what have you. And then my father would sit there and speak to them in Italian. And they'd show them the letter, whatever, and he'd look at it and he'd kind of interpret it. Yeah, here's what you need to do, what have you. So, you know, I guess in that route, in that way, my father had, you know, the altruistic way of, you know, just helping other people. And he was very gregarious. I mean, he held the attention in a room like no other. I always thought my father could have been like a college professor, the way he spoke. And he was, like I said, he was well-read. So there was never a topic I couldn't bring up to him that he wouldn't have knowledge about it. So
how did he learn English? How do you think he, if he came, if he was the, was he born here?
Well, he was born here. I'm sorry if I'm getting it right.
So you said first generation. So okay.
I mean, first generation American Italian, Italian American.
But he learned Italian at home and then he knew English from
back. Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it sounds like he was a good person. He had good values. And then your mom also.
Oh, absolutely. My mother. Yeah.
What did she do? What did your mom do?
I know this term is kind of strange today, but she was a homemaker. I mean, she got a job just to bring in some extra money. I mean,
did your father support her?
He did. He did. But I guess it was kind of, I don't want to say the bare minimum, but I guess he gave what he could to us. I mean, our fam, my mom wasn't below going to the church and getting government cheese and government butter.
Right.
You know, we didn't live. Yeah, I mean, we by no means lived extravagantly. We lived in a 60-unit building. We were on the top floor. But it was clean. It was nice. My upbringing by her was what it should have been. And, you know, I learned basically from it was like almost like, you know, when they say kids brought up by a village. I mean, there was 59 other apartments of people that were, we all knew each other. It was all people that were just old, not old, but a lot of elderly people. You just learn good manners, holding doors, you know.
You were a good boy.
Yeah, I was a good kid. And I guess that in itself kind of played into wanting to go on the right side, as a lot of people did in my neighborhood. I mean, you know, came time to take the interview for the police department. I mean, everybody was out there. It might have been a rough Friday night that we got up on Saturday morning to go take it, but bleary-eyed and all, we got it up, got your coffee or whatever it took you to get your head straight, and got there and took the test. And
What made you want to do that? You could have done anything. What made you wanna
I guess originally going in, I guess a little sense of security because, you know, 20 years retirement, you know, well, hopefully, I mean, in 1975, they did lay off cops, but by the time I was doing this, they were hiring them so much that they had to run different squads of students through the school that they were going through. They were putting like 2,000 trainees through a school that only accommodated 600, 700. So they had to put eight the full 4 to 12s, and it was still crowded for each squad.
But they needed that many people.
Yeah, because they not only weren't hiring from 75 on, but they were laying off cops. So by the time I was going in 9 years later in 1984, it was the uptick where after Gerald Ford famously proclaimed to New York drop dead, and as far as giving the city money to not go bankrupt, now years later it was coming back and things were getting good. And even though the city was even going through some tough times as far as crime and all, which it really was back in the 80s, I mean, when I was a police officer from 84 to 90, those were the years that New York City had led, I shouldn't say, well, of course it led the nation, but that it experienced crime, that we had the most homicides every year through that entire time, to where I think in 1989, 1990, they had 22 homicides those years. And in comparison today, I mean, when you have an uptick in homicides.
22 for the year?
2,200. 2,200.
Whoa.
Yeah. So, I mean, today they're getting 500 maybe at a bad year now, when it's an uptick. So you can imagine how much was going on. And you know,
why were there so many?
Just drugs exploded. Whenever there's drugs, like the famous song by, I believe it was Glenn Frey, where there's Smuggler's Blues, where there's drugs, there's guns. There was a lot of drugs. Crack was coming out, which was really exploding and just causing a lot of hardship. And, you know, you have drugs dealers, they're armed. They got to be. So to prevent themselves from getting robbed. So, I mean, I'm sure a lot of the murders back then were drug related, but it was crazy during those times. But it made for, I hate to say, a good fodder for the book. It was a lot of things to write about during those years.
Wow. So, all right. So let's stick with your police years. I mean, there's so much detail in the book. How did you remember all that, or you had places to go to research it? I mean, it's very detailed.
Unlike what you would think for a typical FBI agent, my memory is not the greatest. Hence, I always kept the pad and pen in my car no matter what, which, I mean, normally when you're driving, aside from listening to music, or especially when I'm on my motorcycle, you get a clear head, you get a chance to like think about things, think about investigations, think about, which pretty much an investigation, for the most part, it's a puzzle that you're trying to put together to the point where you have enough of the puzzle put together that you have the evidence or the clues that you're looking for to further your investigation. So I always kept pen and paper to write down things when I was driving. Hence, at some point when I mean, my intention wasn't to publish things. My intention was, when I first started putting pen to paper, if you will, which was more fingertips to computer, was just to get stories down for posterity's sake that I thought maybe later on, when I'm in my retirement years, on my rocking chair, that when I'm trying to think of stories from back then, where I know 25, 30 years, if not more, I'm not going to remember. But if I get it down on paper, put it on the computer, which makes everything easier to store, that I'd be able to keep the stories to tell friends and relatives and people later on. So that's how it all started, probably.
Now, what made you do the first book? Just another day.
Well, as I was saying, I was starting to put the stories down probably in the mid-90s while it was still fresh in my mind back then. And I could go to my office when I had some downtime and write for a couple hours, write for a day, maybe write for a couple days in a row. And I might not write again for 6 months to a year. And I guess the police stories probably came up a lot quicker back then, that they were still on my mind. Mm-hmm. So that got down. And then as time went on, I was also getting stories, obviously working with the FBI, where I was for 28 years. So as things were coming along, obviously much, a lot more fresher in my mind, I was able to put them on paper or on the computer.
So what made you... You were there for 6 years. What made you switch to the FBI? Is that a normal path, or that's just what you wanted to do?
Not so much then, more now. I mean, the FBI is also always taken from law enforcement as well as military, lawyers, accountants, people that speak more than one language was always the big thing, even more now probably, especially if you speak certain languages. Arabic, Chinese, obviously, but that was a path to be considered back then. And I finished college, had my bachelor's degree back then. It's changed since then, but back then, well, you might have even needed a GED to qualify to be a police officer. Minimum, I know, was a high school diploma. So I joined, I took the test, and police department called. And obviously, FBI, you have to be, I mean, minimum 23. Nobody gets into 23. I mean, I was the third youngest in my class, and I was 27 at the time.
Wow.
So most people, especially today, I guess, are probably in early 30s, basically because obviously the FBI wants people who are pretty seasoned in not only in education but in life before they come there. So, my transition to the FBI.
When I joined
the police department, I wasn't really thinking about the FBI when I joined. I thought that was my career. I was in the police department. Of course, as I said, security is one thing, but you also want to do right by the neighborhood. You want to do good things. We all have this... hopefully a good element in all of us that we want to help our fellow human being. And after I graduated, I got assigned to Harlem and Washington Heights. And Washington Heights, the 34th Precinct,
Is this the police or the?
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is the police department.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm talking about the 28th precinct is Harlem, 34th precinct, Washington Heights. And as much of a fear as when people hear the sound Harlem, when you hear that and you think, oh, wow, it's probably pretty crazy in the 80s. Washington Heights, actually the 3-4 precinct, led the city in homicides during the years that I was assigned there. And it was just – Washington Heights was a place that it's at – not many people know where it is. It's the top of Manhattan. It's from 155th Street to the top, and it's connected by bridges to the Bronx, to New Jersey. And it was a place that had, as does now, very large number of Dominican people living there. And it just so happened that there was because of the geographically speaking, there was so many ways to get there from Long Island, upstate New York, and New Jersey, that it happened to be the place to buy drugs. And it was prolific in terms of the drug sales that were happening up there. And like I said earlier, where there's drugs, there's guns. And yeah, it I mean, shootings daily, and it was just a crazy time, crazy place to work. But in terms of my own getting used to law enforcement, I mean, in terms of me getting ready to move on, which I didn't know at the time, but I mean, there wasn't a place that. When I got to the FBI, it wasn't a place I would be uncomfortable going. There wasn't. I worked in New York for most. I was in California for a year. Then I came back to New York. And I mean, as opposed to a lot of Asians that come into the office, especially at that time, I mean, they might be coming from Omaha. They might be coming from a lot of sections of the country. And I was just familiar with New York, and not just the neighborhoods that I grew up in, but neighborhoods that I had never seen before. Mm. And, you know, I could go with other agents to places that, in a way, I was comfortable with. You know, I could go up to a tenement up on 128th Street and St. Nicholas Avenue. I'd been there before, and it really helped in my transition to the new job, which I didn't anticipate going until a couple of years into the NYPD. I took the sergeant's exam. I was on the sergeant's list. I would have been promoted at some point. I also took the exam for the fire department just in case there was I wanted to make a change, because after a while, you know, 4 or 5 years, all you're doing is just answering calls. You're just going to shots fired, man with a gun. After a while, it's like I need something a little more stimulating. And fortunately, the FBI was the place. I put in an application, and fortunately, by the grace of God, I just had the right minutiae that came out of my mouth when I went to my interview. I was front of the panel with three agents, and I had enough stuff on my application that they looked at it and they said, "Yeah, we're picking you." And I mean, it definitely was a blessing. And I know how many applicants they go through to get each candidate to send to the FBI Academy in Quantico. So I really blessed myself that I got there. And you know, it was a great change. It was a place that you can not only just do law enforcement. And fortunately, through the entire time I was there, I mean, some people get there and they get a little disenchanted, especially if you're a cop or military. And then you wind up going on like back then it was divided between the criminal division and the foreign counterintelligence division. And
wow. All right. On that note, hold that thought. We're going to go to our commercial break, and we're going to come back with some tales from the FBI involving one of your boyhood friends who met you on the other side, right? So,
yes. Yeah.
Right. We'll be back. Okay. Hold that thought. Save that story. All right, good. All right. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Okay, thank you as always to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you want to bring experiential social emotional learning to your schools, to your businesses, to your teams, go to KikoriApp.com and schedule a time to talk. It will change their lives and your life. And if you haven't read my books, I've got all 3 here. You can find them on Amazon. And the Real Talk, the one that last commercial was about, if there are things you're not comfortable talking about, I know some people are, but some people are a little shy, go to realtalkwithhillary.com, get the book, and then send me an email at hillary@gettingrealwithhillary.com, and we can talk, and we'll get you free. And now we're going to bring back, let's see, how did I say it? Former Special Agent, retired Special Agent FBI, and I have to say it right, former NYPD police officer Jason Randazzo with his Tales of Two Directions, we'll call it that way. So would you like to, I know, you know, again, we were talking about these were your boyhood friends, some went to the mob. Some got into drugs, some died, some were killed. You went to the right side of law enforcement, making this world a better place. And, you know, do you want to tell us about your friend? I know he came in and out of your books, both of them, a little bit.
Yes. Okay. I had a friend growing up. We played Little League baseball together. As a matter of fact, he was... His uncle was the coach of our team, and he was he batted third, I batted fourth, and we grew up, we played baseball together, probably 13, 14 years old, and as we went forward, we lost touch. He went to a rival high school, and we played for our respective high schools. Then there came a time after high school was over, I went to college. He went to college. As a matter of fact, I think he went to college in Florida for a while, where he continued. But he was a very good baseball player. And our lives intertwined kind of later on. After I became a police officer, not as much, but my friend became a member, an associate of the Gambino crime family. And
Jason, do you know how that happened? Like, he went to college. It seemed like he was on, I'll call it a right path.
Yeah.
a normal path in Connecticut. That's a normal path. How did you all of a sudden, or maybe it wasn't all of a sudden, become a member of the mob?
As I said, it was a neighborhood where that element was around. So, I had a number of friends who engaged with them, who in a way looked up to them, wanted to be them. You see the movie Goodfellas. It's like Henry Hill says in the movie, you see these guys, they're flashy, they got money, they got the girls, they're having a great time. And, you're always seeing the best part of it, but...
But do you think, because I'm curious about this, how one goes one way and how you went the other. And I know you said, you know, your father was altruistic. He took care of people. Your mother, you know, seems like she had good values. I mean.
What? Why didn't I go?
Why did you go one way and they went the other? Like, did you look at, let's say growing up, did you look at them or did you not see them and think, oh, wow, that's the way to go. They got money. They got flat. Like, would you have ever thought that?
Yeah.
Or, I know it's kind of like whatever environment you're in, that's normal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But why do you think?
Well, I
know you don't know, but just.
No, in a way I do. I mean, like I said, growing up by my mother, by the people in the neighborhood, I just didn't want to, I didn't want to become a criminal. It wasn't in me to hurt people.
Do you think they were thinking, oh, I want to become a criminal? Or do you think somewhere you can fool yourself to think?
Yeah, not so much that you don't think of it as a criminal, but you think, yeah, I want to join this association that engages in illegal crimes, but they're doing well. And I guess it could be like a slow roll into it. Maybe you're just hanging out in the club. Maybe you're just doing small favors. Somebody sees something in you, which I think happened to this one particular friend, that they're like, he's a little kid, but he's a bulldog. He stands up for himself. I kind of like that kid. Where they sort of, kind of like take you under their wing, so to speak.
And so you're almost like groomed.
It is that way.
It's like if you had a big brother.
Yeah.
Who took you under your wing, only some are, yeah. I'm not saying the good guys and the bad guys, but it's kind of like, oh, he likes me.
Or
you're like a gang. Why would you join a gang? Because you're part of a community.
Yeah.
You feel like you belong.
Yeah. Or you're a professional scout. And you see somebody that's got potential and you're like, yeah, this kid might be able to be something that could help us someday, that we can use, that can be part of our thing. So La Cosa Nostra, our thing. And
you think it was, last question.
Sure. Maybe. No, absolutely.
Do you think it was money, more money related or
no.
Power?
No, power? I just think, He was just a tough kid that was in that element that it just, once you get into it and you get to the point where, he was ruling over most of the drug spots, not only in Queens, but probably right over the border in Brooklyn. So he was collecting from these people protection, so to speak. But, if you don't want to get shot in the knee, or baseball battered, as he would say, then you paid them. And those guys are making enough money where a little bit to him is, the price to pay. It's the price to cost of doing business. So, it was phenomenal the amount of money that he was making. And I remember there was one point where a friend of mine had to take his dog to the vet. And this friend of mine just coincidentally had been taking his dog to the vet at the same time. And I saw him out front. And this is one of the times that I would see him in the early years when I was still a cop. We would come across each other because, I knew his parents. Obviously, like I said, I knew his uncle. And we lived not far from each other. So there'd be times walking the street or what have you, where I'd see him. We'd talk. We'd hug. I mean, we were friends. And there's one particular time that I saw him at the vet. He was out front with a brand new black Corvette. I mean, brand new car, beautiful. And you're like, whoa, you know, somebody's doing something. I mean, you know, we're like early 20s. So I'm driving around a banged up Ford LTD. And, you know, he's in this car. So, yeah, you know, the jewelry, the watches, you know, things are going well monetarily for him. And
did you know what he was doing?
It took a while. First, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
It took a while. By that time, I did. But at first, I just heard, I mean, he was well known through the neighborhood. So first I was hearing the rumors about him, what was going on. And it wasn't until it became evident what was going on, both through the neighborhood, things I would see. And then obviously when I was in the FBI, I mean, I was eventually got assigned to the Brooklyn, Queens Metropolitan Resident Agency, which is in Queens, and the Gambino Squad was there in that office. And it was when I was transferring from California back to New York, I knew there was a possibility, but I was hoping not to go to the Gambino Squad, just because at that point in time, my friend was the right hand man to the top guy in the Gotti family, John Gotti Jr. They were about the same age. And once John Gotti Sr. had his issues, where he was incarcerated, he put in charge of the family his son John Gotti Jr. And my friend had John Gotti Jr. as the best man of his wedding, so that just lets you know how close they were at that time. And I just didn't want to be in a place where I was investigating him. I just didn't want to use my friendship in that way with him. This guy I'd known since 13, 14 years old. And
and how did he finally get in trouble?
A lot of notoriety. I mean, back then, going from junior to senior with the Gottis, they were in the news all the time. I mean, that's one of the things that the other heads of the families and other, even members of John Gotti Senior's own family had issues with him, because, you know, he got these names of Teflon Don. He was always dressed right. He got his haircut every day because he just wanted to look, you know, he wanted to look to the nines.
John Gotti Jr.?
This is senior.
Senior. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he was in the papers. He was Time Magazine's Man of the Year one year. He was just so much in the news that the old time organized crime guys hated it, because they weren't in the news. Their thing.
Wait, why was he man? Why was he on Time Magazine as a criminal?
I guess because he ran one of the biggest corporations in the world, which was an illegal one, but nonetheless, it was making money. I mean, they were into everything: waste removal, construction. I mean, back in the '80s. They just got money from the unions. They ran the unions. They just had everything at the time. And I don't know how he got to be telling him in a year. I didn't read that issue, but he just had such notoriety that he was in the news all the time.
Even though he was doing, everything was illegal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, he had gone to trial, I think, three times, federal court. I mean, everything was out there, even though he got not guilty. I don't want to say exonerated, but not guilty the first trials, until he finally was convicted in the last trial. And the case agent for John Gotti Sr., I knew the case agent because he was right in the office. And although when I would see my friend, I made sure that, you know, when I got to the office and I saw the case agent for John Gotti Sr., I let him know that, hey, just to let you know, I came across him in the street the other day. We spoke. So I don't know who's – I mean, it could have been my own job surveillance teams watching him. And then they see, oh, we have an unknown subject. They can contact with him. taking my pictures. Then I'm in my pictures in the office.
Wow.
Like, whoa, wait a minute. We know this guy.
So you had to tell them.
Yeah.
Right.
I had to make sure that, you know, any kind of contact I had with him was just innocent enough. We weren't doing anything nefarious together. So yeah, it was, I can't say a fine line, but there was a line that I, you know, I had to walk that with that for a long time. And my friend, he also was in the news a long time because at some point in time, they caught up to John Gotti Jr. And there was a couple trials with him. And then my friend obviously was getting investigated throughout. And there came a point where he had to run to Brazil to try and avoid extradition, which didn't work out because the authorities in Brazil put him in jail down there. And
which is this, John Gotti Jr. or your
friend? No, this is my friend. And this is during the time that John Gotti Jr. had been going through, I'm pretty sure he went through more than one trial. And there finally came a time where.
Why did they put him in jail in Brazil?
Because they knew who he was and why he was in Brazil. So. There came a time that another agent who I knew very well, we worked on the same squad together at one time, and he was working on the Gambino squad, and he was the case agent for he and his partner were the case agents for John Gotti Jr.
Wow.
And yeah, there came upon a time where they extradited my friend back to New York, and my friend wound up testifying against John Gotti Jr. At a trial. And like every other organized crime, especially at that time, every organized crime trial was in the papers, in the news. And my friend had testified at a number of trials leading up to that. I believe all of them that he testified resulted in convictions. And I would go to those trials, as I did on one or two occasions with the Gotti trial, and sit in the courtroom. And I would sit somewhere where you could see me, because I know most every face that he's looking out there in the courtroom are either people he doesn't know or law enforcement that only knows because of what happened, or like a lot of people that were in there were family members, associates, or what have you, of the person that was on trial. And I knew mine was the only face that he could look at and say, hey, there's a friend that I've known for, you know, 30 more years, played baseball together, hung out together, a lot of good times. I mean, this is a personal thing for him to be here. And I felt that would be comforting to him while he was, you know, testifying that, you know, that I was there. And, you know, it worked out well, except when one time during the John Gotti trial, when I was sitting there, and I was only there for a couple of days. I was there when he was being cross-examined by the defense, and because I figured that's when he kind of really needed some support. And while I was there, the defense attorney asked him, do you know Jason Randazzo? And I must have went white, and I'm sure everybody who was sitting next to me looked at me like, whoa. And there was a multitude of questions to him about our relationship.
Wow.
And it was
so you could have gotten in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I made sure that I spoke to the people on his squad and let them know what was going on. But
Jason, we are out of time, unbelievably. But I would say just another day, get that. If you want to hear the rest of this story, because it weaves throughout Jason's life. It's so interesting being on both sides. And then the day after, I would definitely get them if you want to hear real stories, police stories and FBI stories. Definitely get that book. And in closing, Jason, what would you want for the world? I know, you know, we had talked about some other stuff during our pre-conversation, but how would you want to see the world? I know you have a good heart. You believe in people. How would you want to see the world? in just one or two sentences?
Real quick is, I mean, I don't have it in me to write any more books. I pretty much put all my stories out there, but I did, at the urgence of, or to say a push of a friend, I finally joined, X, and I have, Jason Randazzo 44, the number I wear when I, play ball. And, after doing becoming a very voracious reader of, history, I've just, seen a lot where I just started to write some op-eds that I would send into the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, New York Daily News. Obviously, I have a bit of a conservative slant, but those papers probably don't look upon as gracefully.
And what is your main, your main objective? And just real quick, because we'll run out of time.
Just that society has just become, very few media people have said, very divisive, where we just, you know, we may have opposing views, we may have different ideologies about life, we may have different views on wars in Ukraine and Israel, but I mean, we're all generally nice people, good people that, instead of trolling, instead of just shouting down, not letting people voice opinions, we can all speak. We can all debate. We can all talk to each other. I mean, that's what used to be done up until, the divisiveness that's come to the internet where, and even public speaking where, you know, people will go just to yell people down instead of like open up a forum to talk about these issues. Let's just not hear your side. There's always room in the middle, no matter, nobody's right. Nobody's wrong. Totally. We all have, a middle ground that we can all reach. And I just like to see people in this country come closer to that rather than where we are right now.
And we could build each other up instead of tearing each other down.
Absolutely. We have before. Hopefully we will again.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Any last word in closing?
I hope better days are ahead for this country. And we're not continue to go in the direction we're going.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your courage. Let's see. Your joy, dignity, and courage. Thank you. Thank you for serving New York and this country.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. And we'll see you all next week.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started Getting Real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.